All right, let's get this party started.
Well, we finally made it happen, Sean.
I like writing. I like reading. I like to immerse myself in books. So that seems like a pretty good career choice.
If you want to know how to be discovered in today's industry, then you need to talk with people who have actually been discovered in today's industry.
Doing this, we're going to be undercutting the noble calling of writer and generating instead pixel-stained techno-peasant wretches.
You should never start a creative endeavor that you're not a little bit worried might be impossible.
It can be an ongoing source of inspiration and a continuing challenge.
This is Moses Sirigar with Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing, and I'm here with Dave Wolverton, who is also known when he writes fantasy novels as David Farland. And we're hanging out in St. George, Utah, which is Dave's hometown, or at least currently. You've been here for a while, haven't you?
Yep, 6 years.
6 years. We're at the tail end of the Writer's Death Camp, a wonderful workshop that Dave puts on. It's really neat. He counts up the amount of words that you write at the end of each day, and whoever has written the fewest words, he actually kills them. He's got a big, it's like a halberd that like goes back in your family for like many years, and it's pretty awesome. He's pretty good with it. So it's been fun. I'm still here. We got one more day to go, so I'm hoping to make it through the weekend.
Tomorrow.
Yeah.
Tomorrow's your day.
Okay. All right. I also met you this year at the Superstars Writing Seminar when you guys did it in California, and there's another one coming up in the middle of January. That's going to be in Salt Lake this time. And Dave's an interesting, you're interesting to me because you seem to have a little bit of a Midas touch with some writers. You know, you've known a number of people. You've been telling us stories about giving advice to Stephanie Meyer mm-hmm. way back when, and you knew a guy named Brandon, is it Sanderbergerson? Sanderson, right?
Sanderson.
Sanderson. Okay, yeah, Brandon Sanderson. I knew that. But I'm kind of curious about some of those stories. I mean, you've known a lot of people, and they've taken classes with you or workshops with you, or you've sort of mentored them. Maybe if you have some interesting stories about some of those types of people that have come through your life.
Well, yeah, I've worked with a lot of writers. It started really, I think, with Writers of the Future. I began working with them after I won the Gold Award back in 1987, and 1988 they invited me back again. In 1989, Aljos asked if I would be a judge for the contest, and so I started working with new writers, right out the gate. By 1991, 1992, I was asked to be the coordinating judge, so I was the first reader and coordinating judge, and so I started working with new writers, and I had a lot of people at conventions who began asking me to teach writing workshops, so I did a few of those. And I was then shortly afterward asked to teach creative writing at Brigham Young University. So I taught the science fiction fantasy writing course. And between all of those things, I just had a lot of people that I started working with and helping along. And a number of them went on to become famous. Brandon Sanderson, Brandon Mould, Dan Wells, of course, Stephanie Meyer, Eric Flint, Sean Williams from Australia, and so I just I don't know, had a lot of fun doing it. I've enjoyed doing it. When I quit working with Writers of the Future and went to California to work as a movie producer, I still wanted to keep on teaching a little bit, so I kept doing my writing seminars from time to time, and I guess it's just kind of grown over the years. I do a little service called David Farland's Daily Kick in the Pants. I had several people over the course of a few months who said, you know what would really be helpful, Dave, is if you just come over to my house and give me a kick in the pants every day and get me writing. And I kept thinking about that. I thought, how silly, they need to. And then one day I realized, I could do that. I could give people a kick in the pants. So So I write a little advice column, and I send it out every day called David Farland's Daily Kick in the Pants, and it goes out to a couple thousand people around the world now. And so it's kind of fun. I get to kick people in Australia and New Zealand and the United States and South America and Europe and, you know, Africa, and it's pretty fun.
Yeah, I blogged about your daily kicks recently, and I defined insanity as not subscribing to your daily kick service mm-hmm. because it's free. And here's this established author telling us all about the business, and it's neat because you do different things. You talk about craft, and you talk about the business, and you talk about everything in between. So it's really kind of an inside scoop. It's one of the best things I've seen out there, and it is free. So yeah, that's davidfarland.net, right? Is that your
it's
website?
Actually, it's davidfarland.com.
Okay,
now too.
My bad. So davidfarland.com.
We have them both.
Okay. You can go to davidfarland.com to sign up for that. It is a free email service. I mentioned superstars, and I know this time you've got a new person on board. And one, the fact about her that's so interesting is she's had 14 number one New York Times bestsellers in the last 2 years. Sherilyn Kenyon, is that mm-hmm. how you say your name? Mm-hmm. So as I'm sure you've had to explain this before, how does someone write 14 number one New York Times bestsellers in 2 years?
Well, you know, Sherilyn has several series going at once. So she, I believe it's three series at once. And I think that that's just a testament to the popularity of her work as a whole, but also to each of the series, that each one of the series is hitting number one on the New York Times bestsellers list every time that she puts out a book. And so I don't know anybody else who's had 14 number one New York Times bestsellers in 2 years. I mean, I'm sure that maybe James Patterson or John Grisham or somebody like that might have come close, but that's a huge number.
Yeah, I'll be there. So I'm gonna hear what she has to say. Mm-hmm. Yeah, some other neat things, neat facts about you. You recently won, I saw the Whitney Award for the best novel of the year mm-hmm. this year, yeah, for your book In the Company of Angels. That's pretty cool. You've won the Philip K. Dick Memorial Special Award, is that how it's how
yes.
said?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And another factoid about you, something I'm not happy with you about, is that you came up with the concept of lurkers in StarCraft, mm-hmm. right? And I played Protoss a lot, so really, uh-huh. I don't know if you have played much, but the lurkers are really
enemy, yeah.
pretty annoying, you know? So, yeah, I don't know about that one, but we'll just skip that and move on to the next thing, I guess. So we've talked about some really fun things here, and I want to give you a chance to maybe tell a story or two. I've got my notes here about the Romanian situation, the Japanese T-shirt, and the million-dollar movie rights. Now, you were talking the other day about ways that you know these certain authors who have managed to make some interesting sums of money beyond what you might normally expect. And some of these stories were kind of phenomenal, so I just want to give you a chance to talk about those.
Sure, yeah. Well, what I talked about is very often as writers, you can be living in America and you can make, you know, large numbers, large amounts of money in other countries and have no visible means of support here in the U.S. And there was a cyberpunk writer, for example, a few years ago who, he was sort of popular in the early 80s and or in the mid 80s and on into the early 90s. And, you know, I started noticing that his books were gone and everything. But I read an article one day about his Japanese T-shirt rights. And it turns out that he was popular enough in Japan that one day somebody offered him $50,000 a year for his T-shirt rights, for pictures of him on T-shirts. And so even though he wasn't publishing in the U.S. at the time, his books were popular enough in Japan that with his Japanese publishing money and his T-shirt rights, he was able to make a living. Okay, another writer that I knew back in the early 90s was writing vampire novels, and her vampire novels became very popular over in Romania, and she became the number one best-selling author. And this was before the fall of the Soviet Union, and so she basically was offered She was told, hey, you know, the Soviet Union's, you know, getting ready to collapse. We have a huge problem with inflation here. And so, you know, how about if we take your money and go buy a house? And so she said, sure, let's go buy a house. And I said, that way you'll be able, when you come to Romania, you'll be able to visit and stay in your house. Well, she finally went ahead and the Soviet Union collapsed a couple of years later. She went over to visit her house and discovered that her house was a huge mansion with something like 40 bedrooms and 50 acres of land and stables and riding grounds and, you know, this type of thing. And so she as an author hadn't been making much money and in fact had quit writing by that time, I believe, or was on the verge of it. And suddenly she had this mansion that was worth millions of dollars. She was able to sell it as a bed and breakfast inn. I believe it was to the Hilton Corporation. Mm. And so, you know, once in a while you'll get something like that that just goes absolutely crazy. You know, many authors that start out here in the United States, they'll go overseas and they'll sell book rights, you know, in another country, the way that Dan Wells, for example, sold I Am Not a Serial Killer, his young adult novel, to Tor, and got a you know, normal advance for a book that size. But when it went over to Germany, the Germans absolutely went crazy over it and went into auction. You know, he suddenly found himself trying to figure out how to shelter his money from the income tax and, you know, leave his day job as quickly as possible. And so very often those types of things happen to us. It just, you know, it's just one of those ways that you make money. And you can also do it, of course, with things like movie rights. You know, you may have a book that doesn't do very well at all, some producer's wife reads it and loves it and says, you know, make the movie or I'll divorce you. And next thing you know, the book, you know, takes on a new life as suddenly you have, you know, 50 million people watching it at the movies and on television and things go crazy. So yeah, that's just part of the career.
Yeah, that's one of the fun things. I've done a couple workshops with you now, and I think one of the neat things I've gotten out of that are these stories of what's possible, and it just sort of expands mm-hmm. your mind and teaches you some things about writing as a business. So mm-hmm. It's been great. I'm curious to ask you about yourself a little bit now, too. You've obviously been a writer for a long time. You've talked here at this workshop about how you started off writing for contests, and you mm-hmm. went out and won contest after contest after contest. And of course, you've written science fiction, you've written fantasy, you've written other things too. Now you've always also had an interest in teaching and mentoring other writers, but you're doing, you know, a fair amount of teaching these days with your workshops, obviously, also. Mm-hmm. And by the way, for anyone hearing this, you can go again to his website. It's davidfarland.com, and there's a page about his workshop, so you'll find out he's got like a novel rewriting workshop, an outlining workshop, a professional writer's workshop, the Superstar Seminar is another thing Dave is involved with, and you also have become really involved with movies recently. So mm-hmm. I'm curious now for you, you know, for your passion as an individual, is it pretty equally divided? Are you more interested in any of these areas right now? Teaching versus writing versus movies, and maybe you could talk a little bit about your experience with movies now too.
Okay, sure. Yeah, you know, the thing that interests me about writing is it can take you so many different directions. Each one of us has our own career, and I know writers who, you know, want to write the same kind of novel over and over again. You know, they love epic fantasy and they want to write sword and sorcery and that's what they do from the time that they begin writing to the time that they die. I tend to get bored pretty easily. You know, I've found that I enjoy just about every job that I've ever had for about 3 to 6 months, at which point it's killing me. and so what happened was I find, though, with writing, every time that you write a new book or you step into a new genre or you're writing to an age group that's different, all of a sudden, you have new skills to learn, and that sort of relieves the boredom for me. I also believe that people of all ages, you know, from kids who read picture books to old grandpas, ought to have great literature for them. So I try to, you know, I mean, I've written picture books, I've written middle grade, I've written young adult, I've written adult novels, you know. I've kind of covered the spectrum. And I didn't set out to try to write every kind of novel. I think it's probably a bad idea because you don't develop a deep, you know, deep penetration into an audience by writing to a whole bunch of different audiences. Having said that, it's been really enjoyable for me. And, you know, I took a stint in video games for a while back in the mid-1990s and worked on StarCraft's Brood War was one of my first ones and scripted a few other video games. I worked as a movie producer from 2001 to about 2004, trying to get my RuneLords movie made, and we raised millions of dollars and lined up distribution through Warner Brothers and everything before it all fell apart. and so I still love doing that kind of thing, and I'm looking at starting another movie company, working with another partner. But really, my love is writing, and my love primarily is, I'd say, writing fantasy. That's the thing that I keep coming back to. And I don't think I'm ever going to really get away from it, even though I might work writing a screenplay for a big Jackie Chan movie in China here earlier in the year. And it was a lot of fun, but I didn't like traveling to China for 3 months to do it, and it was pretty... pretty tiring and difficult, and I was sitting there much of the time wishing that I could work on my novel. so I keep coming back to writing my fantasy. At first, when I began writing, my first novel was sort of a Latin American cyberpunk book, and I wrote it, and I went to my publisher afterwards and turned it in, and they said, "Well, this is really great. What are you going to do next?" And I said, "I'd like to do a big, fat fantasy, sort of like Lord of the Rings." And my publisher at the time said, "Well, Dave, you just became a best-selling science fiction author. It takes most people 20 years to get where you got with your first novel. You know, we won't take fantasy from you." And so I kept writing science fiction and edging toward fantasy for the next few years, and celebrated my 10th anniversary of writing science fiction by moving into fantasy and just writing one as a birthday present to myself.
Wow.
So I do all of these things. I've been offered full-time teaching positions at universities, and I've said no. And I've been offered jobs as some movie producers with other studios and whatnot, and I keep saying no. And really what it comes down to is I just love writing. And so that's what I'm going to keep on doing. But I'll do all these other things on the side.
Is RuneLords, is that series complete, or are you still...
I'm working now on the final book in the RuneLords series. Now, having said that, I may do another series set in the RuneLords world, but I have a video game company that's interested in doing a big, massive, multi-user online role-playing game. And so we're in talks about maybe the possibility of doing that, and I might launch a new series along with that game. But it would be set a couple thousand years in the future, or in the past, I should say, before the RuneLords story itself starts. So it's dealing with the development of forcibles and the discovery and invention of them, this type of thing.
Cool. What was it like working for Blizzard with StarCraft II?
Well, with Blizzard, actually what it was there was a small company called Sapphire that was in Orem, Utah. And I read about them in the paper, and I went down to visit them, and I said, you know, hey, I'd love to do a video game based upon my new RuneLords manuscript, which was just in manuscript format at the time. And so that had to be 15 years ago. And in any case, they said, well, we'd really like to, you know, if you're going to do that, you're going to have to, you know, we'd like to get some experience writing with us. So they said, are you any good at writing proposals? And I said, I'd just been working at Brigham Young University, helping professors write proposals for a couple of years and had quite a bit of experience. I says, yeah, actually, I'm really good at writing proposals. And so they said, great, why don't you write a proposal for us? And we did the proposal for StarCraft's Brood Wars. I sat down, wrote it with a couple of the programmers over a period of a few hours. We faxed it off. And it doesn't, in my memory, it doesn't seem like it was any time at all before we got a, we received the confirmation. I think I went down to the grocery store and I was getting some milk. I got my milk and got home, and the phone rang and they said, yeah, Sapphire took the proposal. So I was put as the co-leader of the design team with a fellow named Alan, too, and we just came up with the ideas for StarCraft Brood War and went through, and with each idea, we'd come up with half a dozen different ideas for new types of monsters and half a dozen weapons and half a dozen spaceships and things like that, and then work from the design there.
Did you plot out the story on that? Or
you know, the story at the time was... Had been pretty well developed. We had come up with a story when a couple of the engineers came up with a story. So I kind of embellished it and made it pretty and lengthened it a little bit. But we had pretty much come up with a story, you know, right from the gate.
This episode of Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing is brought to you by Tome of the Endergates, a fantasy epic from Sam Sykes. Adventurer. The term has long been synonymous with cutthroat, murderer, savage, zealot, and heathen. And Lenk, an errant young man with only a sword and a decidedly unpleasant voice in his head, counts all five among his best and only associates. Loathed by society and spurned by all merciful gods, he and his band are recruited for only the vilest of jobs. Full of razor-sharp wit and characters who leap off the page and into trouble, and plunge the reader into a vivid world of adventure, this is a fantasy that kicks off a series that could dominate the second decade of the century. Visit AdventuresInSciFiPublishing.com to learn more and find Tome of the Endergates at a bookstore near you.
Let me see, switch topics here to some business stuff about publishing. Mm-hmm. I found it really interesting. You mentioned to us here, and I heard someone talking about this at World Fantasy as well, that maybe the next big thing might be a young adult sort of space opera, sci-fi mm-hmm. type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm curious how Joe Schmo out there, who's a writer, might have been able to anticipate something like that, because it was interesting here you had said that if you've got something like that ready or close to ready, you know, maybe get it in to someone by January, because recently there's been kind of this talk about this sort of thing. Is there some sort of, how does that memo get out there, and how does anyone find out about it until before it's too late to wear because you have to, you know.
There are no memos. You have to be psychic. now, let me kind of go back here. You know, a few years ago, when the book Harry Potter first came out, I was among the first readers in the U.S. who got a copy of it, because I was writing for Scholastic and my editor sent several books to me and said, Dave, we want to know which book we should push big this year. What do you think? Okay. I gave it to my wife. My wife, along with other 30 other books, and my wife picked out Harry Potter and started reading it, and then my daughter picked out Harry Potter and they were fighting over it. So then I looked at it and did an audience analysis for it, which basically said this was perfect for the young adult market, except that it was written at a level that was too high and it was too long. And so I talked to David Levithan, the editor there, and I said, Harry Potter is the book you should push this year. And he said, well, that's what I said, but the marketing department disagrees. And I said, you know, well, this is it, okay? This woman's a genius at audience analysis, and this is really huge. And so she began pushing it. And at that point, what it did was it created a huge fantasy market. It's what we call the what I call the halo effect. Okay, and I took that from Chris Rush, who first described it, that basically when an author writes something that's so huge that everybody else starts trying to jump in and, you know, get into that audience, then you have what we call the halo effect in publishing. And it basically builds a little bubble of interest in that type of thing. And so I went to some publishers and I said, by the way, the next big thing is going to be contemporary fantasy, you know, typically set in some sort of alternate world that's got either a, what we call a door story, where you get a door into an alternate world, or it's going to be contemporary fantasy set in our world, where you've got some strange things going on in another society or something. Gosh, it was about 2001 that Stephanie Meyer took my class at BYU and, you know, asked, how do I become the best-selling, you know, author in young adult? And we talked about the need to write about, you know, about romance and about the draws for teens, and the draws being the emotional draws, the things that pull teenage readers into books. And I said, by the way, it needs to be set in another world, but it has to be set in this world. And, you know, and even if you write this book, the big question is, are you going to find an editor and an agent who are smart enough to recognize what you've done? And, you know, to her credit, she went out and wrote it and found the editors and agents that she was looking for. And so a lot of it has to do with just, I don't know, sort of a gut instinct, but also recognizing where the next bubble is. Hunger Games just came out, just ended. It was a short series. It was too short. The series was growing really huge. And so there's a number of publishers, a couple publishers in the last month that have bought big, sprawling, multi-world science fiction novels for young adults with the idea that this could possibly be, you know, something on the leading edge of you know, the next big bubble. So, you know, it's just a guess. Nobody knows for sure. All that you have to do is go out and write something that's totally phenomenal, and maybe you could be starting the next big bubble yourself. You know, you don't have to follow what the bubble, you can be, you know, on the leading edge of it.
To follow that somewhat inappropriately, I was thinking to ask you about what you've noticed about how things are selling now compared to, I don't know, the last few years, 5 years, and the trends that you've seen, how different genres and subgenres are trending. What do you notice there that's interesting? I mean, of course, I hear that there's not as much money for book deals as there had been previously. That's a lot of that's about the economy, of course. How do you think that's affecting things? How are things shaking out? How are different different science fiction, fantasy genres and so forth changing?
Oh, sure. Well, here's a couple things that are happening right now. First of all, in the two big genres that are really healthy right now are thrillers and young adult. Most of the deals that are $250,000 or more for new authors are coming out of those two genres. In fact, we won't see anything, you know, I don't think I've seen a $250,000 deal for a new author in fantasy or science fiction in the last 10 years, and I don't expect to see any in the next few years for the adult market. But the young adult market is really healthy for a number of reasons. First of all, young adults read the books in school. They have to write book reports. They tell their friends about them. So the word of mouth advertising in young adult is great. In middle grade, in particular, you can go. An author can go visit schools, and if you can spend 3 months touring, you know, when you've written a book, and go to, you know, say 200 schools across the country, you prep yourself for becoming a New York Times bestseller. By the time you get to two or three books, if you can do that, you will become a New York Times bestseller. So in those markets, it's much easier. In the young adult and the middle grade markets, it's much easier for an author to go big than it is in the adult market, because there's not a a way for you to attract fans quite as well. So that's a big thing. And we're finding a lot of the readers for the young adult and middle grade are the adults. Over half of the readers for something like a Stephanie Meyer book are adults, mainly because there are a lot of adults who are saying, we want to read clean fiction, and we're tired of the smut and the, you know, the perversity and the violence and whatever. And so they are looking for good fiction, and they figure that that's a good haven for them. So I think that that's a trend that's going to continue. Of course, the big thing that's happening right now, is ebooks. You know, the ebook market is exploding. And I wrote back in April, I said, you know, with the advent of the iPad, the ebook revolution is here. I said, you've got a color tablet, it's big, it's glossy. Even kids who don't read want them because you can play video games on them. And, you know, now Best Buy has come out and said, hey, they've cut our book, notebook computer sales by 50%. They are taking a tremendous amount of the market. And, you know, this ebook revolution that people have been prophesying for 15 years is finally here. Okay, because there are readers that are competitive and exciting, and everybody's buying them, and everybody will buy them. And within the next 2 years, a lot of schools are going to start going to e-readers rather than textbooks. Everything's going to go digital because it's going to save money for the schools and allow them to flip over their investment in textbooks on a yearly basis instead of, you know, they'll get a licensing fee and get all of the textbooks from Macmillan or something like that. And it'll work really well for them. So the interesting thing here is that we're moving into an era where you as an author are going to have a perpetual income from any book that you put out. There won't be books going out of print anymore. You won't have a career that will ever die, you know. Even if you die, even if you quit writing for 10 years, you'll probably still be collecting a paycheck of, you know, a few hundred or maybe thousands of dollars per month that's going to come from your residual sales. So that's an exciting development. Given all that's going on, I just see things keep on plugging along. There really isn't less money in the book industry right now. Sales have dropped a little bit, and there are a couple of publishers that are hurting. But the main problem that we have is that the market is changing. And whenever you have changes, it's good for some people and bad for others. You know, Borders is in a really tough place. They have a lot of money. They've got stores that are closing. They don't have a great ebook program. And they may not last for the next couple of years. I hate to say that, but they're in a scary position. Meanwhile, Barnes & Noble seems to do pretty well, and Amazon.com, of course, is swallowing the whole publishing world, you know, has become the largest book retailer in the world, both with its sales of books, the number of hard copies it sells, but also they're selling far more ebooks than everybody else too. And so Amazon.com is just really taking over. And, you know, that's just sort of the way the industry has always worked. You know, 20 years ago, everybody was bemoaning how the little independent bookstores had been dying out. Now, all of a sudden, in this great big ebook market with the advent of Amazon.com, there's a lot of new little publishers or little bookstores that are starting up that are, you know, mystery bookstores, science fiction bookstores. They're finding that the specialty bookstores are saying, yeah, people want to come in and browse. They want to buy these kinds of books. And suddenly, as Borders is closing its doors and these big guys are cutting back, suddenly there's room for new retailers out there. So the markets, I think, are actually pretty healthy. It's just they're just shifting so much that it's difficult for a publisher to get a handle on, you know, how big it is and how well is it going to do. Hmm. You can look at the sales for, you know, somebody like, tour St. Martin's and see that, you know, they don't have a lot of ebook sales. You know, maybe they're running, you know, 15%, and yet their profit margins are up by 25% because the ebooks are saving them so much money that, you know, quite frankly, what's going to happen is ebooks are going to end up saving the big publishers. You know, it's in that kind of situation now.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah, I thought it was interesting because, of course, this has been changing so quickly. I got turned on to this stuff a little bit earlier, early on this year. I think a little ahead of the wave mm-hmm. compared to some folks. So when I went to Superstars, that was in March of 2010, March of this year. And the advice you guys gave collectively, I would say at that point, was pretty much don't even think of self-publishing. Ebooks are not a big deal. And you know, and then I mean, within a few months, things changed.
Yeah.
You know, I was already aware of it at that point, so I was sort of asking questions, saying, "Well, wait a minute, you know." But, you, I think of all the guys who were there. I mean, Kevin J. Anderson, Brandon Sanderson, Eric Flint, Rebecca Mester were there on the first one. But I noticed you in your Daily Kick, you said something that was fairly pro e-publishing fairly soon after Superstars.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you get turned onto some of this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You told us this weekend that if you don't get special placement in a bookstore when you get traditionally published, you may be better off e-publishing on your own even. Now, what do you want to say about that?
And I think I said even as early as March that, you know, we are moving into a world where the rules will change, you know. And I think I even then I said, right now, you know, as of March 2010, the best thing that you can do, and this is still true here, you know, 6 months later, the best thing that you can do is go out, sell your book, get placement as much as you can in the big bookstores, and go that way. But we're moving into an interesting age where, you know, very often people have been fighting for, you know, can I get a great agent so that I can go sell my book big? And that is one way to get a sale. But there are publishers out there who say, if you go out and put your book out in ebook and you get 2,000 sales in, you know, 6 months, we will publish your book. Because we believe that that's a sign that you've got a lot of interest in your story. And so we're moving into an age where I can foresee that in 2 or 3 years, you might take your book, go put it out on ebook, and if it reels in a lot of customers, that might be as big as getting a huge agent, you know, to handle your work. That might be what interests the agent, you know, because they can't argue with real readers, you know. They can't argue whether there's an audience if you've already got an audience. And so, you know, there's, like I say, times are changing really fast, and you just about have to go from minute to minute to day to day. I've also told people don't self-publish. I self-published my own book last year, you know. And even as I wrote the article, I was thinking of self-publishing, and I wrote an article. I said, don't self-publish. Everybody's talking about self-publishing your book and doing a POD book. I said, that is not the way. There's not a single self-published author that I know who's become a New York Times number one bestseller in fiction. You can do self-publishing in some of the self-help genres and become a bestseller. But in fiction, I haven't seen it done yet. And so, you know, it's kind of, don't try it. Go for the traditional route. It works better. You know, thousands of people have done that. Nobody's done the other. Could you do it? Yeah, you could do it. It's possible. There may be ways to do it. But it would probably take a whole lot of money and a whole lot of backing, because to become a New York Times bestseller in your own genre, you might have to go print $1 million worth of books, and then you're going to have to pay cooperative advertising with the bookstores, and that's going to be a few hundred thousand. And you might have to spend a bunch of money on advertising yourself beyond that to get ads in all the major magazines and this kind of thing. So the promotional costs and the printing costs will run a couple $1 million, but you could do it. You know, there's got to be ways to do it. And maybe there's even ways to do it with POD books, you know, print on demand books. But I think that as an author, I want to be worrying more about how to plot and write my next novel than how to make $1 million trying to figure out how to do it as a POD book or pushing it heavily as an electronic book. So that's kind of the way that I handle things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there have been some stories already of people who are going from, you know, ebook to traditional deals. There's a somewhat well-known one, Boyd Morrison, maybe a couple of years back. He was kind of, I think, more of a mainstream thriller type market. And just recently, Michael J. Sullivan, who's written a six, he's working on a six-book fantasy series. He had five of them out. He's, I think, getting picked up by a publisher right now because he was doing pretty well with his series. And so then the publisher bought up all six of his books in his series. And Rhiannon Frater got picked up by Tor. She got a six-figure deal for a zombie trilogy kind of thing that she had on Kindle. So I'm sure, you know, as you said, these things will become more and more common. There are some people already managing to pull that off. And then another thing that's happening is Amazon Encore. Amazon has a publishing division now, and they basically look at their own sales. And if they have an independently produced book, and they look at their own data for it, and they decide, oh, we could take this in. They do a free edit on it, and they redesign the cover, and then they use their own muscle to promote it, and you know, email people that might like it, and give it good placement on Amazon.com, and they make authors be very tight-lipped about the terms of that deal. They never talk about what the deal is, but they all say they're very happy with Amazon, and they work with them really well, and they help them, and they, you know, do a good job of promoting their stuff. So it's one of the reasons I've been really confused, you know, this year, is that, you know, because I know more than one person who's been snatched up by Amazon Encore this year, just doing their own thing. And so it seems like it's, you know, it's a good time for authors because we can do a lot of things and get out there. And if the fates smile on you, then good things can happen to you. Right.
Yeah, we are living in interesting, changing times. And one of the things that could happen to you right now that worries me is that if you write a book and you go through the traditional publishing route and get a whole bunch of money now, you may be hurting yourself in the long run because your e-rights are partly owned by your publisher. And you don't have any control necessarily over what mediums they get sold in or how much the price is charged. And you might be giving up, say, 50% of your royalties, over a long period of time. And that could be, like, you know, 20 years from now, I might be kicking myself, saying, I wish I owned all the rights to the Rune Lords. So these changing times, it's hard to judge, you know. Like you say, you almost have to have a crystal ball to figure out what is the right thing to do. And sometimes I wonder if people who are selling ebook rights now and going in directly into POD and self-publishing in the long run, that might be the right thing to do. Another thing that a person can do, though, is you can take matters into your own hands in other ways. There are a lot of independent producers and directors out there, and you could go take a book that you've written and take it to them and say, would you be interested in the movie rights on this? You know, we're looking at making this into film eventually. And I knew an author years ago who printed up 50 copies and sent them out to a bunch of different directors, got three of them who were interested in making movies, and they began bidding against each other, and he got himself a nice movie option that way that he wouldn't have gotten if he had waited for his agent or his publisher to do anything. So being proactive in your own career is smart no matter what field you're in, and particularly in a creative field like this.
Wow. Well, I'm going to see you again in 2 months in Salt Lake, if all goes well for the Superstars, and we'll find out how much things have changed between now and
then. Exactly.
I'll be interested to hear how, you know, Kevin and Brandon and Eric and everyone and Rebecca and your new person, how they talk about the new Sherilyn Kenyon, how they all talk about the new publishing world, and it'll be neat to see how different it is compared to what it looked like 10 months prior to that, when we all got together. So well, let's go ahead and wrap this up, and I'll send folks again hopefully to David Farland, David Farland either .net or .com, you have options. there is a little video that I filmed with David. It's on his website now when you go to his writing workshops link. And basically I asked him about the different workshops he offers, and he talked about them on that video, and there's also text you can read about those different things. And
I'm getting ready to start my new novel rewriting workshop too. So if you've written a novel and you're trying to figure out how to make it publishable, hopefully that'll be helpful for people.
This is an intensive workshop for people who've already written novels, right? Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So that looks like that would be really practical. So yeah, lots of great stuff here from Dave, and it has been fantastic to talk to you. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing. Please visit adventuresinscifipublishing.com for show notes, book reviews, film reviews, videos, coverage of live events, and so much more. You can leave us feedback at adventuresinscifipublishing@gmail.com or call the voicemail line at 206-350-5029. All contact information can be found on the About Us page on the website. Until next time, keep reading.